Welcome to another deep dive. You know how this works. We take one source, a book, an article, whatever, and we just really get into it, see what it's all about. Today it's Last of the Gnostics. It's by Dawn Durrett.
Durrett.
Yeah, Durrett.
Okay.
So this book, Last of the Gnostics, not just a history book, right?
Right. It's more like he uses this story about the early Gnostics to kind of dig into some big ideas, you know? But spirituality and power, especially these Cathars in southern France, they had some like major run-ins with the early Catholic Church, and it gets pretty intense.
And what makes it a good deep dive for our listeners, I think, is this idea that at the core of it, Gnostics believe that you have a direct connection to the divine. Like you don't need a church or anything.
Yeah, no middleman between you and God, basically, which you can imagine didn't exactly go over well with the church, right? I mean, they were really trying to solidify their power back then.
Right, exactly. So Dirk's not just talking about ideas here. He's showing how this belief played out in real life. And sometimes things got really, really brutal for the Cathars. He weaves this whole history of their persecution with their spiritual beliefs, showing how they connect.
It's fascinating. Really well done.
So chapter one, Mary Magdalene's Gospel. Right off the bat, Durrett starts with this scene of Mary at Jesus's tomb. She's grieving. Very human, very relatable, even after all this time.
Absolutely. And then boom, Jesus appears to her. But not like, resurrected body Jesus, more like in spirit.
Right, and this is a turning point. Jesus gives Mary these instructions. Tells her to take their children, Sarah, Miriam, and to go to France, to the Essenes. Spread his message. But it's more than just that. He talks about how this message will fade, almost disappear, and then boom, come back in the end times.
Huge scope, right?
Huge. And then we see her talking to Anna, Jesus's grandmother, and Sarah and Miriam.
And here's where it gets really interesting. They're all family, first cousins, granddaughters of Anna, this inner circle, super tight, and it really emphasizes how personal this whole movement was at the beginning.
And their understanding, their spiritual depth, it's presented as being like equal to Jesus. They seem to get it maybe even more than some of the apostles later on.
Right, like they have this intuitive grasp.
So the man is to go to France, with Joseph of Arimathea, no less. But then Anna gives Mary this advice. Tell the apostles she saw Jesus, which was a big deal in itself, but don't tell them everything. Don't tell them about the message or the plan to go to France.
A little bit of secrecy. It kind of foreshadows how things are going to go down with some of the apostles, right? Like, not everyone's going to be on board with this.
Yeah, there's definitely some tension there. So they meet up with the apostles, Peter, Simon, John, James, all the big names. And Mary does share some of Jesus's teachings, specifically about what she calls the seven demons.
And these aren't like literal demons with horns and tails. They're more like these internal things, obstacles to spiritual growth.
Right. Like almost psychological in a way. So what are these seven demons, according to Durrett?
Oh man, there's a bunch. Okay, so first you have darkness, but it's not like actual darkness. It's more like being disconnected from the nous, that spark of the divine within.
Right.
Then there's craving, that desperate need to connect because you feel separate from God. Then ignorance, that's like the ego, like some things of.
The ego. Always got to get in the way.
And then bitterness, holding on to things, being sad about them, attachment to stuff, basically.
Material world stuff.
Exactly. Then the body itself, desire for pleasure, all that.
Okay.
And folly, that's when you're chasing after knowledge that doesn't really mean anything, just superficial stuff.
Yeah, like trivia night knowledge, not soul knowledge.
And the last one is it's guileful wisdom. Like you're right there on the edge of enlightenment, but you hesitate. You're afraid to let go of your ego completely.
Wow. So that's the Gnostic view of what holds us back. Pretty insightful, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
So how do the apostles react to all this?
Mixed bag, really. Peter and Andrew, they're not convinced. Maybe they were already thinking about a more structured, organized kind of movement.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that's important for the story because while those guys stay in Jerusalem, laying the groundwork for what becomes the church, Mary, Sarah, and Miriam, they head off to France with their families and Joseph of Arimathea. They're taking this different understanding of Jesus's message with them.
Right, it's like a branching off point, two different paths from the same source. So chapter two, the Essenes in France, they land in Languedoc, specifically aiming for Mount Bougeroc.
Yeah, and this is key because that's where Sarah grew up with the Essenes. Those guys were all about, simple living, mysticism, that kind of stuff.
Right, so they already have a connection there, people who might understand them.
Exactly. So Sarah introduces Mary Magdalene as Jesus's wife, which emphasizes how close she was to him, and tells them about their mission to spread Jesus's teachings. And these scenes, get this, they already knew about Jesus. He'd visited before. They recognized him as like this really powerful spiritual figure.
Wow.
So right away, there's this sense of like, we're on the same page. And Mary proposes writing a gospel to capture all this deeper stuff. They agree, but with one condition: only the perfecti, the most advanced Essenes spiritually, will be allowed to preach this message.
Okay, so that's interesting. They're really emphasizing spiritual purity, not just anyone can teach this stuff.
Right. And then the Essenes do something really surprising. They decide to leave their communities. They were usually very isolated and go out and spread these teachings actively.
Wow, that's a huge change for them.
Total turning point, going from inward focus to outward.
Yeah, like a missionary spirit. Durrett also mentions that Mary Magdalene introduces some new customs, like saying the Lord's Prayer before meals and bedtime.
Right, integrating Jesus' words into their existing practices, blending traditions. We even see Sarah and John, one of the Essene Perfecti, going to preach at a port, you know, talking to regular folks.
So are people receptive?
Yeah, it's really cool, actually. They talk about Jesus' resurrection, but not like a physical thing, more like he's present in God's kingdom. It's a different spin on it, you know?
Spiritual, not political.
Right. They also share some sayings from the Gospels of Mary Magdalene and Thomas, emphasizing things like the divine spark within everyone, that God's kingdom is both inside and outside us, and, you know, the dangers of getting too attached to material stuff.
Makes sense. And this is the beginning of the Cathar movement, right?
Yep. Cathar comes from the Greek word for purity, and their priests were called perfecti. Durrett draws a lot of parallels between them and the Essenes, their diet, their lifestyle, their whole pursuit of gnosis, that direct experience of the divine.
Okay.
And they start spreading pretty quickly. The perfecti travel all over Languedoc, sharing their version of Jesus' message.
Interesting. It's cool that Durrett points out the reference for Sarah, too, in southern France, like the Black Madonnas and that festival, Saint Sarah the Egyptian.
Sarah Kali.
Yeah, that one.
It shows she really made an impact, and maybe it reflects how open the region was to female spiritual leaders.
It's important to remember the political side of things, too. Languedoc was pretty independent back then, ruled by these powerful families, Aragon, Toulouse, Béziers, and they were generally pro-Cathar.
That made a huge difference. It gave the perfectional legitimacy, respect. They even lived in some of the noble houses, you know, advising, blessing meals, performing the consolamentum, this ritual we'll get into later.
Okay.
So it was a very different vibe from the Catholic Church, which people there were pretty anti, yeah.
Yeah, they had their own thing going on. So chapter 3, just called the Cathars, shows how things had changed by the 12th century.
Yeah, a lot of time had passed since Mary and her group arrived. The Essenes as a distinct group had kind of faded out, their ideas absorbed into the Cathar movement.
Makes sense.
A lot of perfecti were still wandering around preaching, but those communal Essene settlements, not so much anymore. The training to become a perfecti was still hardcore, though, focused almost entirely on gnosis. They basically stopped studying the Old Testament.
Interesting. So what were the key Cathar beliefs at this point?
Well, they really doubled down on this dualistic view. Like, God is all good, that's our true nature, and we can access that through gnosis. But the material world, that's all messed up, fake, and separate from that divine goodness.
Okay, that makes sense.
And they used the Cathar cross as a symbol. It has this connection to the Knights Templar, who were also pretty critical of the church.
The Templars, right.
Oh, and they had this unique idea about the afterlife. They believed only the perfecti went straight to God's kingdom when they died. Everyone else had to reincarnate back into this messed up material world.
Wow, that's pretty different. So not the usual heaven and hell for everyone.
Yeah, totally different. And get this, the people in Languedoc actually accepted this reincarnation idea. It became pretty mainstream there. Meanwhile, in the rest of Europe, the church was getting really aggressive, burning people they considered heretics.
Yeah, not a great time to be different.
No kidding. By 1165, the Cathars were at their peak. Thousands of perfectory all over Languedoc, super respected, influencing everything.
But that kind of success usually attracts attention, doesn't it?
Totally. And the papacy definitely noticed. They saw the Cathars as a huge threat, a heresy that had to be wiped out. Things escalate. And in 1176, they hold this big meeting, a synod in Albi, where they officially condemn the Cathars.
Sounds ominous.
Oh, yeah. And now Dura introduces us to this really wise perfectic, Pierre. He lives in the castle of Lord Charles in Lauragais, which was like Cathar central.
Living the good life.
Right. But he's also super respected. Even at these fancy dinners with the nobles, they listen to him. It shows how integrated the Cathars were into the highest levels of society there.
Wow. It's kind of amazing how different Languedoc was from the rest of Europe. Durrett mentions the status of women there, too. They had a lot more freedom and equality.
Right. They could own land, have power. Men would even, like, bow down to women perfectus, asking for their prayers and stuff. It was a very different world.
A different world. And that's a good thing in this case.
Yeah, absolutely.
But Pierre, even with all this acceptance, he started to get worried. He sees the writing on the wall. He knows the Pope and the French king could team up, and that would be bad news for the Cathars.
Yeah, he's definitely sensing trouble. Durrett also talks about these training centers specifically for women who wanted to be perfectus.
Okay.
Different from the men, who mostly had one-on-one training before Montségur was built. And there's this interesting little story about Lord Charles, his wife Margaret. She wants their daughter to join one of these women's houses. Mm. But Charles isn't into it. He probably wants a more traditional life for his daughter, you know, a good marriage to another noble family.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it just shows how personal beliefs can clash with, like, societal norms.
Right. And the chapter ends with Pierre walking through Fanjeaux, and this desperate guy runs up to him. He's begging Pierre to give his dying mother the consolamentum.
That ritual was a huge deal for them.
So what exactly did it involve?
It's pretty simple, actually. They would put the New Testament on the person's forehead, say the Lord's Prayer, and if they survived, sometimes this was done for people who were very sick, they would give them the New Testament again as a newly initiated persiction on their actual deathbed.
Wow. So like a preparation for the next life.
Exactly.
So we move on to chapter 4, Blanche and Pierre. This is where we really get into the weeds, theologically speaking.
Yeah, lots of deep conversations here between Pierre and Blanche, a noble woman who's really into the Cathar teachings.
Okay.
And they're talking about this big Gnostic idea that God isn't far off somewhere. He's right there inside you, the deepest part of your consciousness.
Like we're all connected to that same source.
Exactly. And that leads to the whole idea of duality. The inner world of the spirit is pure, real, good, but the outside world, the material world, that's all an illusion, a messed up version of the real thing.
So to connect with God, you have to get past that outer stuff.
Right. You have to, like, kill off your ego, your false self. Pierre even says that him being Pierre the Perfectual, that's just a role. His true self is beyond that, and you find it by letting go of the ego.
It's like shedding a skin.
Yeah, exactly.
Blanche seems to really get it. She wants to go on this quest for purity. They also talk about the Gospel of Thomas, which the Gnostics loved.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Pierre explains this line, "Blessed is he who takes his place at the beginning, for he knows in the end he will not experience death."
What does that even mean?
Well, Pierre says the beginning is that eternal source, God. And if you know that source, if you're connected to it, then you're not afraid of death anymore. Death only applies to this temporary material self.
Okay, I think I'm following. So without that knowledge, you're basically lost in the world, just going through the motions.
Pretty much. Blanche even says that without this knowledge, life is just like utter nonsense. She's got a way with words.
She does. So the Gnostic path is all about finding your way back to God, to that pure source.
That's the journey.
Okay. So chapter 5, the second omen, 1184. Things are starting to get a little darker now.
Yeah, the trouble begins. This is when the papal bull ad abolendum comes out of Rome.
What's that?
Basically, it's the Pope telling the local clergy to be on the lookout for heresy, to report anyone who's not following the church line.
Like informants?
Yeah, basically. And it worked really well in other parts of Europe.
But not Languedoc?
Not so much, because a lot of the priests there actually sympathized with the Cathars. Some even supported them outright.
Wow. So the church had much less control in Languedoc.
Yeah. And that's really important for understanding how the Cathars were able to thrive there for so long.
Makes sense. But even though the ad abolendum didn't have an immediate impact, Pierre sees it as a really bad sign. He says it will lead to persecution being burned at the stake.
Oh, yeah, he's got this prophetic sense. He connects it to a prophecy in Mary Magdalene's gospel about a time of great hardship for the perfection.
Heavy stuff. So Blanche is understandably freaked out. What does Pierre tell her?
He says this is just the second omen. There's a third one coming, something even worse.
Oh.
Yeah. And he's worried that the only thing protecting the Cathars is the support of the nobles. If they lose that, they're in big trouble.
And that makes sense. The nobles had the power to shield them.
Exactly. Then these two Cistercian monks show up in Lorac, their mission, to preach against the Cathars, of course.
Oh, boy.
It all comes to a head in the town square. Pierre steps up and debates these monks, defending the Gnostic beliefs and really going after the church.
Tell me more about that. What did he say?
Oh, man, holds nothing back. He says, "Gnostics value knowledge, gnosis, not blind faith like the church." He even says the church is a man-made thing, so it's basically satanic.
Wow. He's really going for it.
Yeah, he doesn't pull any punches. He also criticizes them for persecuting women who want to be spiritual leaders.
Right, women had a much higher status in the Cathar community.
Exactly, and he calls out their hypocrisy. They claim to follow the apostles, yet they persecute Jesus' descendants living right there in Languedoc.
That's a good point. So who wins the debate?
Oh, Pierre, hands down. The crowd's totally on his side. They love him, and they're kind of spooked when he warns them that if the Cathars are gone, Languedoc will lose its spiritual light, you know, become a worse place.
Powerful stuff. Okay, so on to chapter 6, the third omen, 1199.
Yeah, things are really heating up now. We see Pierre looking older, more worried. You can feel the tension rising. And then the hammer drops. Pope Innocent III issues this new papal bull.
What does this one say?
This one's a boozy. It says, heresy isn't just a mistake, it's a crime. And it's punishable by death, not just for the heretics, but for anyone who helps them.
Oh, wow. So no more messing around.
Nope. And Glanch is totally shocked. Pierre, he's grim. He says, this Pope, Innocent III, he's not like the others. This guy means business. He thinks he'll get the French king on his side, and then it's game over for the Cathars.
A powerful alliance. Scary stuff. How does Blanche react?
Well, it makes her really question things. I mean, he sees Ela's beauty in the world, and she can't square that with the Cathar idea that it's all Satan's domain, you know?
Right. She's struggling with those two ideas.
Big time. So she decides to go talk to Count Raymond VI in Toulouse, see if he can do anything. Meanwhile, Pierre is talking to Blanche's daughter, Joanna.
14-year-old Joanna. What are they talking about?
Pierre's explaining the difference between Catholic and Cathar beliefs. Catholics believe in this separation between humanity and God. You need the church to be saved. But Cathars believe we're already connected to God through the nous, that spark of the divine inside us.
Two very different views.
Oh, yeah. And Joanna gets it. She even criticizes the Catholic viewpoint, says it's based on fear, not love.
Smart kid.
Super sharp. Pierre's impressed, but he still thinks the Cathars are doomed.
That's so sad. So what's the Pope up to at this point?
He's going all in. He replaces the Qatar-friendly bishops with these hardcore Cistercian guys. But he still needs the French king's army to really do any damage.
Right.
And then it happens. King Philip Augustus gives the go-ahead for a full-blown crusade.
Game changer.
Big time.
Okay. So, chapter 7. Here we go. The Albigensian Crusade begins.
The Pope assembles this massive army, 30,000 men.
30,000.
Yeah. And they're head straight for Béziers. The city's given an ultimatum. Hand over all the heretics or else. And the people of Béziers, they refuse. They're loyal to their perfidy.
So what happens?
Oh, man. It's brutal. The papal legate, this guy Arnaud Amaury, he gives the order, kill them all. God will know his own. They stormed the city and massacred almost everyone.
Oh, God. Indiscriminate killing.
Women, children, everyone. It was horrific.
Just awful. How would Pierre take this news?
He's devastated, obviously. He knows this is just the beginning of a long, bloody conflict.
Makes sense. What about Blanche?
She's frantic. She's worried about all the perfectus, especially her daughter, Joanna, who's at Monsigur.
So what does she do?
She decides to go to Toulouse to beg Count Raymond VI for help. Meanwhile, the Crusaders move on to Carcassonne.
Right.
They capture the Count there, Raymond Rogers Trencavel, and demand they surrender all heretics. Of course, the people resist, and they end up burning 41 prefectuary in the city.
God, it's just relentless.
Totally ruthless. So Blanche finally gets to Toulouse and meets with Raymond VI. She tells him about the massacre at Béziers, about Carcassonne falling.
What's his reaction?
Well, he still thinks they can defend Languedoc. He's confident. He respects Pierre and supports the Cathars. But he also knows the French royal army is a serious threat.
Yeah, he's not naive.
Nope. So he tells Blanche he'll defend Toulouse, but he advises her to bring all the perfective to the city for safety.
Smart move. Get him out of the more vulnerable areas.
Yeah, exactly.
So we move to chapter 8, the Perfecti Women's Home. Blanche goes to Montaigur to see Joanna.
Yeah, and she finds almost 50 perfective taking refuge there. They've come from all the places that have fallen. Béziers, Narbonne, Carcassonne.
Monsigur is becoming a safe haven.
Absolutely. Gilbert de Castres, one of the perfect Sisyphal leaders at Monsigur, he welcomes Blanche. And they talk about how surprised they are that more nobles aren't fighting back.
It's like we're giving up without a fight.
Yeah, pretty disheartening. But the focus then shifts to Joanna. She's teaching the women and girls who are also at the women's home.
Okay.
And they're all scared, understandably. Joanna tries to comfort them. She talks about how the soul is divine and eternal, and its real home is God's kingdom.
Right.
And she talks about Jesus's resurrection, but not as a physical thing. It's more like an ascension to a higher spiritual level.
A spiritual model for them to follow. Interesting. Does she talk about the violence? The crusade?
She does. She talks about free will, how God gave us the choice to do good or evil, but he doesn't interfere with our choices, even when those choices lead to bad things happening.
That's a tough concept to grapple with, especially when you're facing persecution.
No kidding. And she emphasizes that the perfectaire, their job is to live good lives, to bring peace into the world through their actions.
So even though they can't stop with it, they can still choose how to respond to it.
Exactly.
Chapter 9, the first battle, 1210. Situation's getting worse.
Yeah, the Crusaders, led by Simon de Montfort, they take Minerve in terms. More perfectia are burned alive.
God.
Raymond VI, he sees the burning at Minerve and it really shakes him. Blanche goes to see him after Terms falls and she's just heartbroken. So many of her friends are gone.
Can't even imagine. What does Raymond say?
He's getting pretty fatalistic. He even wonders if Languedoc really is the land of Satan with all this suffering.
Wow. He's losing hope.
Yeah, a little bit. And he warns Blanche that Montfort is going to attack Laura Gaze next after he takes Cabaret.
Oh no, Blanche is home.
Yeah. And Raymond won't help her. He says he has to focus on defending Toulouse.
I get it, but it still feels like he's abandoning them.
It's a tough spot to be in. So Cabaret falls, and Blanche rushes to Montségur to tell Gilbert and Joanna the bad news.
Things are looking bleak. And amidst all this chaos, Joanna's still teaching. What's she focused on now?
The nous, again. That connection to God. She talks about how the Catholics misunderstand it. They think it's this distant thing.
Right. But for the Cathars, it's something you experience directly.
Yeah. And Joanna uses this great image to explain it. She says souls are like spokes on a wheel, and God's soul is the hub.
So we're all connected to that same center. Love that image.
Me too. It's really powerful. And she emphasizes that Jesus said the kingdom of God is within you.
Yeah, I remember that.
So it's not about external stuff. It's about finding that inner connection. And she says the biggest obstacle is our own mind.
Our thoughts.
Yeah, all that mental chatter, the judgment, it keeps us from experiencing the nows, from finding true peace.
It's so true. It's like our minds are our own worst enemies sometimes.
Totally.
Chapter 10, Blanche and Robière. A little bit of good news for once.
Yeah, a small victory. Raymond VI manages to defend Toulouse against Montfort's attack in 1211.
Final.
Robière rushes back to Lorac with the news, and Blanche is so relieved.
I bet. But it doesn't last, does it?
Nope. Robière comes back later with more news, and it's not good. Montfort has captured Castelnaudry, even though Raymond had more men.
Oh no.
Yeah, it shows how determined Montfort is and how strong his army is.
Not good.
Not good at all. So another year passes, and Blanche goes back to Montségur in 1212. She tells Gilbert and Joanna that things are really bad. Montfort's army is stronger, towns are surrendering left and right, Perfecti are being burnt everywhere, and Saint-Michel-de-Lannes is gone.
Oh, wow. They must feel so trapped.
It's a terrible situation. Even Joanna, who's usually so strong, she starts to despair. Blanche just tries to comfort her, but there's not much she can do.
Heartbreaking.
Totally.
Chapter 11, The Statute of Pamiers. Another turning point.
Big one. Antoine goes to Raymond VI with some shocking news. The Catholic bishops, with the Pope's blessing, they've changed the laws of Languedoc.
Okay, how?
This new law, the Statute of Pamiers, it basically gives the church control over the land and inheritance of anyone who supports heresy.
Wow. That's a direct attack on the nobles who protect the Cathars.
Exactly. And Raymond VI, he gets it. He realizes the king might be using this whole crusade thing to take over Languedoc for himself.
So it's not even really about religion anymore. It's about power.
Right. But then, in early 1213, a Perfecti comes to Montségur with incredible news.
What?
He says the crusade is over, the Pope has stopped it, and they can all go home.
Seriously, what a relief.
Yeah, everyone's overjoyed. But of course, it's too good to be true.
Of course. Chapter 12, The Siege of Toulouse.
Right, so Blanche is so happy to have Joanna back home in Lorac, and they visit the women's home together.
Nice.
Yeah. Joanna goes right back to teaching. She talks about initiation, about awakening to the nous. She even says Christ went through initiations, you know, like steps on his spiritual path.
Interesting.
And she compares the soul to a spark of God's light.
Beautiful.
One of the girls asks about reincarnation. She's scared of being born back into this world, into Satan's realm.
Yeah, I could see why she'd be afraid.
Joanna tells her not to worry. It's just part of the journey. We keep learning and growing lifetime after lifetime.
So you don't lose the progress you've made. That's reassuring.
Yeah, definitely. And then she talks about enlightenment. It's like realizing the world is an illusion and that your true self is this eternal spirit. You become of God, not just something created in the world.
Okay, that's pretty deep.
Yeah, Gnosticism is full of that stuff.
So Blanche is still worried, though. She thinks Montfort will attack Toulouse.
And she's right to be worried. But in April 1214, the Pope stops the crusade again.
Seriously? Again?
Yeah, I know, right? Antoine brings the news to Raymond VI, and everyone breathes a sigh of relief. But later that winter, Blanche goes back to Montségur, and there are over 50 Perfitti there now.
They keep coming.
Yeah, it's becoming the last stronghold.
So what about Toulouse?
Raymond VII, he's in charge now because his dad went to Spain to get more soldiers. He's under pressure to attack Montfort, but he holds back. Montfort does siege Toulouse for a bit, but he's mostly after money, not Perfecti.
So maybe there's a chance they can hold out.
Maybe.
Chapter 13, the crusade is paused. 1219, another break in the fighting.
Yeah, it's 1217, and Raymond VI comes back from Spain with 500 mercenaries. Montfort has left Toulouse.
Good news.
Yeah, for now. Robière keeps Blanche updated.